So far we've
we spent three or four chapters looking at Moses, and we see his hesitancy to go before Pharaoh. And the last, God continues to work his plan, but the last verse of the last chapter that we studied last week, what was Moses' response when he was told to go to Pharaoh again? Remember? Yeah. And he just continues to focus on himself, and God wants him to focus on what? This is my plan. Many years ago, I said this was going to happen. This is my plan. Stop worrying about yourself. I've got this. This is. I'll give you the things to say, and I'll show you the things to do, and I know what's going to happen. But God answers him in verse 1. He says that he has made him, talking about Moses, like God to Pharaoh, and that Aaron would be his prophet. Now, remember when it wasn't too long ago that Pharaoh treated Aaron and Moses like what? Somebody's saying it. I can hear an S. He treated them like slaves, right? He told them to get back to work. So now they're going to be treated as something a little bit different. Aaron is to tell Pharaoh again to let God's people go. But God is praying that Pharaoh will not listen and that he would harden Pharaoh's heart, even though God would display signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. So remember the discussion that we had about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. God says that he would lay his hand on Egypt and bring his people out by great acts of judgment. So, as we've alluded to, the confrontation here is between the one true God and all of these little Egyptian gods that they worship. Because as we'll see, and you can really make the case that a lot of their gods are involved. We'll talk in a minute about some of that. But Exodus 12:12, notice what it says. God says, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord." And also in Numbers 33:4, it essentially says the same thing. We talked about, and we had a slide last week, I think we had maybe about two different lists of gods, and we said that that really wasn't all of the gods that they had. They pretty well had a god for most everything that they did, and they tried to please those gods in all of their everyday activities. And the thing to think about is, most of those gods had animal heads or animal traits. And I'm going to read you something. I probably should have put this on a slide, but let me, if you'll indulge me here, I want to read you something here that I had put down here about Egyptian religion. "Ancient Egyptian religion was not a monolithic institution, but consisted of a vast and varying set of beliefs and practices, linked by their common focus on the interaction between the world of humans and the world of the divine. The characteristics of the gods who populated the divine realm were inextricably linked to the Egyptians' understanding of the properties of the world in which they lived. The Egyptians believed that the phenomena of nature were divine forces in and of themselves. These deified forces included the elements, animal characteristics, or abstract forces. The Egyptians believed in a pantheon of gods which were involved in all aspects of nature and human society. Their religious practices were efforts to sustain and placate these phenomena and turn them to human advantage. This polytheistic system was very complex, as some deities were believed to exist in many different manifestations, and some had multiple mythological roles. Conversely, many natural forces, such as the sun, were associated with multiple deities." So keep that in mind, and what that must have looked like to them. You know, they could look at normal things in nature and worship those things. And I think we'll see that that's what Pharaoh was doing to the Nile. But if you look at some of these major ones that we picked out, that I picked out here, the Hapi was the god of the Nile, and you look at the plague of water to blood. We talked about the Apis bull last week, the death of cattle. Hathor, you can also say, was the death of cattle plague was aimed right at that god. Imhotep, their god of medicine, you know, boils could be seen as an attack at that god. Bob and I were talking about this one, Amun-Ra and Ra, the sun gods, and you probably have heard about those before, and we'll get to the darkness plague, and then the hail. And those are just ones that stood out. There's probably lots of others that overlap that you could probably do that with as well. So, when you probably have heard others try and explain away, or at least partially explain away, some of these plagues as the result of natural phenomena. You ever heard any of that? Pardon? Yeah. Exactly. Well, water to blood. Well, really, you know, at certain times of the year, the Nile will flood and it will wash down this particular soil, and it turns this way, and so the idea of God's power being shown in a supernatural way can't be accepted at face value for a lot of people. But when you look at all of these plagues that were done, these were intensifications of, you know, you look at the frogs and the lice, intensifications that would go way beyond anything that would naturally happen. And also, what about the hail? The hail is going to happen tomorrow, and it's going to happen right here. If I told Lamar, hey, Lamar, you're going to get hail at your house tomorrow. It's not going to hail over on, 31, but it's going to hail right at your house. There you go. But that would be something you'd say, wow, how was that done, right? Yeah, and even when they imitate it, you have to be thinking, you know, yes, we imitate it, and I'm probably getting on a point I was about to make here in about 10 minutes, but they can imitate it maybe just enough to have Pharaoh continue to harden his heart and believe, but you've got to be thinking when they're trying to imitate that, they realize at that time that that's not anything of the sort. What I'd like us to think about too, as we look at these plagues, and this is in some ways a supposition, but we know that the Israelites settled in Goshen, so Joseph's brothers settled there, and that is, from everything I could see, maybe about 50 miles from where Pharaoh probably was, somewhere around Memphis or Cairo. So think about being maybe about 50 miles distant from a couple of those plagues we'll talk about tonight. All right, let's go ahead and take question number one, and Lamar, we'll start with you.
Why did God send the plagues to Egypt? References, chapter 7, verse 5.
Yeah, exactly. And I think these other verses will talk about that as well, but you can also answer that same question not just with verse 5, but if you look at a lot of the other verses, we can answer that question a lot of different ways. Lamar mentioned verse 5 there, but look at verse 17. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, with the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water that is in the Nile, and it shall turn to blood. Exodus 8:22. But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people dwell, so that no swarms of flies shall be there, that you may know I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. And in 9:14, for this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself, and on your servants, and on your people, so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. 14:4, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. 14:18, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. So, to show I am the Lord to the Egyptians, but also to show I am the Lord to the Israelites. 6:7, which we've already studied, I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And 10:2, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. 15:11, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? But also, obviously, to show God's power. 9:16, but for this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. But also to punish Egypt for their treatment of Israel. Psalm 78 we'll reference a couple of times tonight. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but gave their lives over to the plague. We already talked about that this is a judgment on those gods. But also to show that God made a distinction between his people and the Egyptians. Thus I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign will happen. In 11:7, but not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. But also to cause God's name to be spread over the earth. We already looked at this at 9:16 and 10:2. But to produce fear in the surrounding nations that God would defeat them. So be thinking a little bit further ahead. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. So, just to produce fear, because what they were supposed to be doing at some point in the future was to go into Canaan and conquer those nations. But also to give courage to the Israelites as they do that. Deuteronomy 7:17-19. If you say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt, the great trials that your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the mighty hand, and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So will the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. So he is beginning now to show them exactly who he is, both the Egyptians and the Israelites. Because remember, the Israelites have also been witness to this same worship of all these little gods. But also to cause Israel to keep God's statutes. Deuteronomy 6:20. When your son asks you in the time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and statutes and rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs, wonders, great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that He might preserve us alive as we are this day. Question number two. Yeah, and I think we had alluded to that earlier, and we sort of chopped up Moses' life almost evenly, 40, 40, and 40. So, verse 6 says that both Moses and Aaron did exactly as God commanded them to do so. Then God says to both of them, "When Pharaoh says to you, 'Prove yourselves by working a miracle,' then you say to Aaron, 'Take your rod and cast it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.'" So if you're Moses, if you hear this, you should already be getting the feeling that God knows exactly what is going to happen. So you're preparing yourself for this, and He's already given you a means to confront Pharaoh. So that's exactly what happens. Pharaoh summons his wise men and sorcerers, and it says that they did the same thing with their secret arts. I didn't look at any of the other translations. Do the other translations have enchantments? Anything else besides that? We could probably have a little bit of a debate on that as to exactly what that means, and were they actually able to do it? Was it sleight of hand? I'll go back to something I said a minute ago when Lamar made his comment, and that is it was at least enough to satisfy Pharaoh to continue on the same decision path that he was on, right? So, I'm not sure. You look at some of the other things that they were able to duplicate, and it's a little bit difficult to understand that. Question three.
What impact did the magician's imitation of the miracle have on Pharaoh? Verse 13, it's harder and harder.
Yeah, and remember what we said about that? Did Pharaoh continue to have free will during this time? Could he have let them go at this moment? All right, so question four.
What were the names of the two leading magicians? 2 Timothy 3:8 mentions Agenis and Jambres.
Right. What is Paul's point here when bringing them up? If you look at the context of that, what point is he trying to make?
Well, he just got there talking about these false teachers who would go into households and were basically leading whole households astray. Of course, the comparison he makes is, just as these people resisted Moses, these people are resisting the truth.
Well, and these people were the magicians were learned people, right? At the same point that they were learned people, but they weren't they weren't able to use that learning for anything that was Well, yeah, we're not told a lot there, are we? Just that they resisted Moses. Right.
I wondered the same thing, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time looking into it. But the one reference that I did look at, they said that the origin of the names was from Egypt. But I couldn't find anything that was in it.
I understood it
to
be from a Jewish oral tradition. The stories that were told backed up.
Yeah. Well, and is it likely that we have every single event that recorded that Moses did? Probably not. I mean, we don't have everything, I would think. All right, question five.
God, when Moses threw that rod down, that was a miracle. That was God's servant.
his power is superior, right? I read one commentary that discussed the Hebrew word for serpent as translated into crocodile. And when you grow up looking at thinking about the rods turned into serpents and this sort of thing, it gives it a little bit different meaning when you think about crocodile, right? I mean, that's a whole different story. So I'm not sure of that. So I don't know. It's just very picturesque. So God then says to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he won't let the people go. God tells him to go to Pharaoh as he's going out to the water in the morning. He takes take the same rod that turned into a snake. And so we look at Pharaoh two or three different times going out to the Nile in the morning. And that's either seems to be either an act of worship or that's his ritual to do that. But God knows exactly where Pharaoh is going to be, and he sends Moses there. He says, tell him the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to tell you to let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But so far you've not obeyed. So by this you'll know that I am the Lord. With the rod that's in my hand, I will strike the water in the Nile. I'll turn it to blood. The fish in the Nile will die, and the Nile will stink, and the Egyptians will grow tired of drinking water from the Nile. Then Moses, you tell Aaron to stretch his hand out over the rod, or with the rod over the waters of Egypt and over their rivers, canals, ponds, and pools of water. So he does so. And it says that even in vessels of wood and stone, the water was blood. So then Pharaoh asked his magicians to do the same. They imitated it. And as we said before, Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. So obviously they were able to do something to satisfy him. It seems to me it would have been much more impressive for them to change it back from blood to water, right? So it makes you wonder. Verse 23 says that it uses the phrase, Pharaoh didn't even take this to heart. So something like this was done, and he doesn't even take it to heart because of what his magicians do. Let's go ahead and take question 6, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah, it's huge to them, huh? Because that's where they get their water from. That's where they get food from. They worship that. One commentary that I read said that this the entire... I don't know if I can put that back up there or not. As we look at that. That entire Nile Delta is approximately 150 miles wide and 125 miles long. And that would encompass... much of Goshen as well. So if you look at the Nile, and is the Nile in pictures you've seen of the Nile and others who may have been there, is the Nile a narrow river or is it wide? Yeah, but primarily though, it's not a small river, is it? So if look at the enormity of that. If all of that water was turned to blood and it encompassed the whole delta area, 150 miles wide, 125 miles long, and you had all of these people that are depending on that for sustenance. You don't even have that. So what do the Egyptians do for water at that point? What are they forced to do? Yeah, they're digging along the riverbank for water. And how long did the plague last? And to me, what that sounded like was that it lasted, you know, the water was turned to blood, and obviously you had other water that was flowing down this direction. So it sounded like it took 7 days for all of that to clear up. So it went away by itself. There is, you know, just like we look at historical writings from Josephus, lots further back, something called the Epuer Papyrus. Has a lot of history from this time period. And I wrote some things down that, some quotes from it. It says, "Plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere." And then in another instance, pretty close by, it said, "The river is blood, men shrink from tasting, human beings, and thirst after water." And then just a little bit further down from that, it says, "That is our water, that is our happiness. What shall we do in respect thereof? All is ruin." You know, you think about how significant this must have been to them. This is the first plague, and how significant that this was. And you think about the impact on the Egyptians themselves just with this. But as we get further on, I can only imagine how they were feeling and ready for this to be over and not really understanding what was going on. So God tells Moses to go back to Pharaoh, tell him the same thing. "Let my people go. If he refuses, tell him I will plague the land of Egypt with frogs. The Nile will swarm with frogs. It will be so bad that they'll come up into your houses, to your bedrooms, on your bed, into your servants' houses, and even into your ovens and kneading bowls." And I looked up ovens, and what they were using as ovens, we looked at some pictures of these, was a if you can envision a hole in the ground that's kind of lined with brick. And so if you're needing to go ahead and make your bread or whatever it is you're making, but every time you go to do that, you've got frogs in the bottom. But not only are frogs in the bottom, frogs are in your bed, frogs are in your house. How many of you have stink bugs in your house occasionally now? And then a ladybug? How do you like that? I don't even like having ladybugs and stink bugs in the house. But if you had all of the, and maybe an occasional frog is fine. This is not the occasional frog. This is lots of frogs, isn't it? Exactly. I think that's toads. That's toads. Well, hold on to that thought, because I will ask what you think about that. But Moses and Aaron, let's see. Let's go ahead and take question 7, and we'll talk about it.
What was the plague of frogs significant? Well, of course,
right. Yeah, if you saw a frog and you recognized that as one of your gods that you should have some respect for and regard for, but then you have all of these frogs so that you're sick of them and you just loathe frogs at this point. I mean, look what God causes them to do. No longer is the frog something to be adored. It's something you can't stand. Another commentary that I read and some history on this, after the Nile overflowed its banks yearly and then receded in the months of September, the appearance of frogs, it was a natural thing, but not to this extent. But the appearance of frogs was a reminder to the Egyptians that the Nile had been fruitful for another year and that the gods had been good to them. In fact, they even believed that frogs breathed the breath of life into the bodies of men. So, that's how much they love frogs. So this was done just as God commanded, but verse 7 says that the magicians imitated that miracle as well. So the last thing they would have wanted was more frogs. So they were overrun with frogs, and then it says they imitated it, so there were more frogs. We mentioned Psalm 78. Psalm 78:45 uses the phrase, when it talks about this very plague, that it destroyed them. That is not something that says that they were able just to get by. They didn't like it, but they got by. It says it destroyed them. Moses, Pharaoh then calls Moses and Aaron and says, plead with the Lord to take the frogs away, and then he'll let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord. So it wasn't that long ago that he said, who is the Lord that I should obey him? So now not only does he change his tune a little bit, he's now pleading with the Lord to take those frogs away. So let's take question 8. Right. And to pick up what you said, Moses asked Pharaoh when he would like him to pray for removal of the frogs, and he said, tomorrow. And that is a little bit puzzling, but might it be that he was trying to save face a little bit, knowing who Pharaoh thought that he was, and possibly hoping that they would go away on their own so he wouldn't have to admit, is the only thing I could think. So Moses does so, the frogs are removed, God's power was shown. What happened, how were the frogs removed? That to me almost would have been worse than just the frogs jumping around themselves. Is that, I mean, was it, what did they do with the frogs, the dead frogs? Yeah, yeah. So they're enough. It says they're in heaps, and so they're starting to stink, and that is really bad. So you had the water to blood. Now that you had all these frogs, they were bad enough. Now you've got a bunch of stinking dead frogs. So it says that the land stank. Now let's take question 9. Yeah, we're mighty humble when we're sick. You know, we don't feel very well, or things are not going our way. But all of a sudden, when things turn, we're not quite the same mindset, are we? Yeah, frogs went away, and so he hardened his heart again. So he wanted this removal of the judgment, but he didn't change his heart. So God tells Moses and Aaron, strike the dust of the earth that it may become, and you may have lice. I had gnats in the English Standard Version. They did so, and they covered man and animal and were in all the land of Egypt. And you know, you may have done the same thing I did. When I read this, and I don't care if it's gnats or lice, I think of no-see-ums. You know what a no-see-um is? I mean, those things can torment you. If you're lucky if you see a black dot, you know, where you can, you know, flick it off or do something else. But if it was that's got to be terrible. I mean, it just would torment them to death. So was any warning given on this one? No warning given on this one, right? We're going to see that there wasn't a warning before the boils or the darkness either. There was a Greek historian called Herodotus, and he wrote about the Egyptians in some of his writings. And I think this may make the point of why this may have also been especially bad. And think about it in terms of dead frogs and in terms of water to blood as well. He said, they wear linen garments, which they are especially careful to always have freshly washed. The priests shave their bodies every other day that no lice or impure thing may adhere to them as they are engaged in the service of the gods. They bathe twice every day in cold water and twice each night. So if that's your custom and you're so fastidious to do that, but now what you're having to put up with is all of this, that's a whole psyche drain to me. The first three plagues here really are going to affect the Egyptians. You know, personally, in what they do every day, having to get food cooked and just live their lives, and also in the worship of these false gods. So as this discontentment builds, you can just imagine they're just thinking, we really have got to get these people out of here, or what is happening here? Let's pick question 10. Well, and this was actually producing life, wasn't it? I mean, Moses and Aaron struck the ground, and the dust became these lice or gnats or whatever, where they're not going to be able to produce life. Only God can do that. So they recognized what was going on. They tried to imitate it and couldn't. So they said it was the finger of God. Was his heart changed at this point? Yep, God said that's what was going to happen. But we're not told what happens to the gnats or the lice or whatever these were, right? We're just not told what happens to them. So now God tells Moses and Aaron to present themselves to Pharaoh again as he's going out to the water in the morning, and say to him one more time, "Let my people go, and if you won't, I'll send swarms of flies on you, your servants, and your people, and into your houses. The houses of the Egyptians will be filled with swarms of flies, and also the ground they stand on." But now there's a change in this plague, and what is it? Yeah, not going to be the Israelites, right? Not going to be anything in the land of Goshen. So this happens. There are swarms of flies. Verse 24 says that throughout the land of Egypt, the land was ruined by swarms of flies. Again, 78:45 says that the flies devoured them. Does this sound like a house fly? Have you ever had a lot of horse flies around? Yeah, I went to summer camp once, and the horse flies were so bad that you try to jump in the creek to get away from them, but the minute you get your head out of the water, you know, they're biting you. So that's just a few horse flies. And if Scripture says it devoured them, it sure sounds to me like it's a biting fly of some kind. The Hebrew word from the commentary that I looked at is similar to the same word that's used in Exodus 12:38, where it says a mixed multitude left Egypt. So maybe there were different kinds of flies. Maybe there were several biting flies that were at work here. All right, question 11. No. I bet if you had three or four of them in your house, that'd be enough to drive you crazy. All right. 11. And he's calling it. I mean, he's calling his shot right here. Look, it's going to happen tomorrow, and it's going to happen here and not there. All right, question 12. Yeah, here's where he starts the compromise. He offers four different compromises as we move forward here with through chapter 10. The first of the compromises he tries to offer is they'll sacrifice within the land in 825. 828, go out of the land, but don't go very far. 10, 8, and 11, the men can go alone, but that's it. And then later on in chapter 10, everyone can go but leave the flocks and the herds behind. So God's beginning to get his attention at this point. All right, and question number 13. Right. And we talked about the Apis bull and how they revered, you know, that bull. And then Hathor was one of the slides that we had, you know. And if they're going to be offering those up, that would be an abomination. So Moses prays to the Lord. The flies are removed. Pharaoh hardens his heart, didn't let the people go. And so that's where we'll start next week. Does anybody have any other comments they want to make?
About this distinction between the Israelites and the people of Egypt. You see that reflected in the New Testament. I mean, we do read that God causes the sun to shine on the just and the unjust, rain to fall, and so forth. And that there are very special blessings reserved for certain people. And so God does still make a distinction. In fact, I love the statement at the end of Ephesians. It said he is head over all things to the church.
Well, and that's you know, not going to be lost on all of these Egyptian people when they start seeing, look, they're not affected. We're affected, they're not affected. Anything else?
Just one other thing I will add, and I certainly don't want to offer any kind of excuses for, you know, idolatry, for the polytheism and all that, but it is interesting that ancient man did a whole lot better job of at least realizing that there's powers beyond my control. There's a lot of stuff going on. It can't be all just me. There has to be something. You know, they obviously needed to learn that there is one God and his true nature and so forth. They did a much better job of at least understanding that.
You can appreciate them wanting to worship when they see things that are obviously beyond their control. But, yeah, you're exactly right. Anything else? All right.